Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Friday, March 11th, 2022. The time is 1:35 in the p.m. We're meeting in the State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, myself as Chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Doug, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. I'll now bring Senate Bill 187 back before the committee. 187 is related to sex offenses, and this is the sixth hearing of Senate Bill 187. We previously adopted a committee substitute as our working document. I received a total of 8 amendments for us to consider. Amendment number 1, labeled G.8, is from my office at the request of the Department of Law. I will move amendment number 1.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman, for purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Casey Schroeder, if you'd please come to the presenter's table and explain amendment number 1 labeled G.8. Please put yourself on the record.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Amendment number 1, G.8, restructures the language on page 4, lines 15 through 16, and then on 17, to clarify that inaction may be considered in the totality of the circumstances analysis. So inaction doesn't mean there was no consent, but it could be included when we're considering whether or not there was no consent.
All right. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Hughes?
Yeah, just for clarification, inaction means physical inaction. In other words, the victim's not moving.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's what we were meaning there, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for clarification, the concern is that without the amendment, the language could be misunderstood to mean that inaction always means a lack of consent. And we want to make sure that's not
the case. Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's exactly correct.
Great. Thank you.
All right. With no other questions, I'll ask Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Is there any further objection to Amendment Number 1? Seeing no objection, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. All right. Amendment Number 2, labeled G.4, is from Senator Schauer.
Move amendment number 2, Mr. Chairman.
I will object for discussion.
If you look at the lines here, we have discussed this with the Department of Law. There were the words annoy or harass, and they kind of, when you, and Casey might want to illuminate on this a little bit, but basically they're kind of interchangeable back and forth. And so for, I like the words she used better than I do. It was clarity in the law that it would be simpler and cleaner if we just use one word, not both, because they're kind of interchangeable. We had a secondary concern that she's not as, or they are not as concerned about, but we still think it could be a problem that down the road an enterprising lawyer might try to find a way to use the word annoy in a way that we didn't intend it, which seems to be a little bit different. So we figured it would be cleaner in this case to go ahead and take out the word annoy and just in every section where it is in the bill. Thank you.
Senator Hughes?
Is the word harass or harassment defined anywhere in statute? In my mind, I use the words differently. A person annoying, I think of a child being annoying is different than a child harassing. Harassment is more in your face with mean intent. So is the word harassment defined in statute?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, it is not. So we look for, when we are talking about harass or annoy, because there is no statutory definition, we are looking at the dictionary. And if we look at Webster's Third New International Dictionary, harass and annoy, those definitions refer back to each other. So annoy means a lot of things, but also means to harass. Harass means a lot of things, but also means to annoy. And so we do not believe that there is a significant legal impact from this amendment, and the department is neutral on it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there's the Department of Law's position on the amendment. Is there any further discussion? I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection? With no objection, amendment number 2, labeled G.4, is adopted. All right. Amendment number 3, labeled G.5, is also from Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 3.
I will object for discussion.
I may not keep this as it is, or I may just withdraw, but I wanted to pull it out for discussion for the committee members and see where they sat on this. We brought this up as initially in one section, which we found out in discussions with law that that's not the section it applies in. It's more, this was really the concern about travel in a state. And ironically, as we went through this in the discussion and the statute was read, which Casey may have for us if we want to pull that out so she can read it, it led to another discussion. I believe there's enough wiggle room, so-called, and how they would apply this that it doesn't apply to the section and how we had the amendment. However, when you read the statute for travel and somebody who has to report in their travel status, they have 7 or more days and they have to report it. It is left open-ended to basically judgment. And it says, and I don't want to misrepresent it, but basically that if they can't report in for some amount of time based on whatever happens, travel status, their phone breaks, name whatever the issue is, and they don't call in, that it's basically left to a reasonable judgment of the parole officer or whoever does the work on this one. And in the discussion, we felt that it should be a little more codified, because when you look at the statutes, there's a lot of places where it's left to judgment, and I think we might want to tighten that up. But I wanted to discuss this because it is left where, in what we brought up as the example, is Michelle and I had done the reintegration training, and I believe some of you may have done that as well, where somebody that's come out of prison is trying to get their life back on track, and it is nearly impossible at times to do that based on all the different criteria. And what we were cognizant of this, or trying to be cognizant of, is are we making it so difficult for somebody to still live that we're setting them up to fail and having more charges brought on top of them? I don't believe that's really the case now with this amendment, but I did want to bring it before the committee, Mr. Chair, and ask if anybody had concerns that that was too open-ended, left to judgment, as opposed to us codifying that section of statute. And it might be helpful if Casey, if it's okay, would just read that section we did, if you would, and then it will make more sense.
Just for the record, I have not recently been let out of prison and working on reintegration.
I hope I wasn't.
I can't talk about the rest of the committee, yeah, Casey, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to let Mr. Skidmore take this one.
Thank you. Okay.
For the record, John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. This particular provision in the statute talks about someone's initial registry, and I should probably start by apologizing. It may have been my comments when we first talked about this that got us confused. The requirement under travel is a new subsection that's added in the bill. The subsection that this one is in talks about the initial registration. And under the federal definitions, under the federal registration requirements, temporary lodging is not meant to apply to when someone travels. Rather, it's meant to apply when the person might have more than one residence. So you have to think, okay, the person has this permanent place of residence, but they have a second place that they like to go and stay, and they stay there frequently. That's not their primary residence. That's not the place that's currently required to be registered under statute, but there's this second place that they may go. And what the federal government says in its guidance is that you want to avoid providing them the opportunity to stay in another temporary lodging where they could commit sex crimes while traveling or visiting away from home. And their concern, the federal government's concern, was that it increases the likelihood of those things happening if they are not required to report on that temporary lodging. And that's what this language is supposed to be capturing, not the travel component. The travel component is also found in statute, but that is only when the person is away from their permanent residence for more than 7 days. And in those circumstances, they're supposed to provide notice that they're going to be traveling, and then they're supposed to provide notice of where they're traveling to. The other thing that I would want to point out is that when you look at these registration requirements and you have to consider, well, what happens if someone doesn't comply with it, you also have to make sure that you consider the defenses that are already codified in state statute. And so, for example, while we are specifically looking at the registration requirements, if you go to the failure to register, which is Alaska Statute 1156-840, and you go to subsection B, this talks about it being an affirmative defense when there are unforeseeable circumstances outside the control of the person requiring to register, and when that person then provides the information to the Department of Public Safety, in addition to, hey, there were circumstances out of my control, the hotel, the motel, wherever it was I was planning to stay was full, I had to do something else. So long as that person then does report into the Department of Public Safety where they were actually staying, they have met their obligations and they have not committed any sort of new crime. So those were the two different things that I wanted to make sure that I highlighted for folks first, and I apologize if my comments in any way misled people, but where this is taking place is not meant to apply to travel. This is meant to apply to initial registration if there is a second or additional place where they reside, not just a primary residence. And then you have the travel requirement. And then on top of that, I also wanted to make sure that I was pointing out the affirmative defenses, which I don't think our conversation last time covered.
Mr. Chair, before just to clarify, because I appreciate that, John, and that does clear it up very well, as we did, is, you know, talking about this before we came down. So his last point was the one I think we kind of settled on, which kind of flowed from this, what we weren't even intending, which is for the committee, is that something the committee is interested in codifying further as opposed to being the affirmative defense, but there is no time limit on that. In other words, it could be 6 hours, sure, before somebody wanted to say that you didn't do it sooner, 24 hours, 48. I understand they may or may not prosecute. That was the question that led to me wanting to bring this before the committee. Is that something, because you could read the statutes and we could find 1,000 of these things, we know it, of all these different subjective criteria. So is that something the committee is interested in? If not, I will withdraw this and move on. But if there is an interest in providing more codified data so that it is not left up to circumstances, I was willing to entertain that, and that's what I'm really asking today, if anybody has questions.
Senator Hughes, did you have a question?
Well, I just got confused. So which wasn't why I raised my hand earlier, are you saying that we don't have the time, like how soon, like whether they have to do this in a certain number of hours or days,
yes,
that if we were to add that?
That's what I'm saying, Senator Hughes, because I didn't have time to get another amendment when we realized that this had changed. So I just wanted to use this as the vehicle to discuss it. We could make a conceptual amendment and change it if we chose. If we don't think it's important enough, that's fine. We can move on. But it did stick out to me that it is a subjective criteria for somebody that goes somewhere when they have to report is left open. It could take them a day. It could take them 5 days. There's nothing that says when they have to do that and when they might therefore potentially be dinged for not reporting in, and I thought maybe we would want to do better than that.
Mr. Skidmore.
Okay. Can I follow up? So I would like to hear what Mr. Skidmore says about that. But in general, if someone has committed a sex offense that requires registry, this is part of the price they have to pay, and it's important that we know where they are. I'm also concerned. I was actually renting a place where I was informed the person next door was on the registry. And, you know, what if that person considered that temporary, so did not report it, and then ended up staying there a year, two years, 3 years? So we get foggy around that, too. So I just think that reporting where the person is important, and there's allowances if things come up out of their control that can be worked out. But I would like to hear what Mr. Skidmore says as far as adding a time, in other words, to address what Senator Schauer brought up.
One more comment from Senator Schauer.
Before John answers, Senator Hughes, that is, there is a 7-day limit on this. So that's just to be clear on that, there's like 7 or more days is when it's required. So just
that's
so that we
registration?
No, for the travel. I'm only talking travel. Now, everything else has been answered. We're happy. I think it's all there. And I agree with you that this is the price they pay, but my point is I don't believe we should leave it open. They need to know what their criteria is, and right now it's kind of left open. There is no hard and fast criteria that they would know that they were told, hey, you have to report by 24 hours if you're not where you're supposed to be, or 48 hours. Right now it could be 6 if somebody wanted to do it that way. That's my point, is did we want to codify it further? That's
okay.
All. Thank you.
And question, clarification. I'm sorry, because Mr. Skidmore is explaining to us this is the initial registration. Now you're talking about something that this.
That's why I tried to caveat.
Separate.
This was
not so should we take care of this first, and then if we wanted, because
yeah,
it would be it wouldn't be an amendment to this amendment, would it be?
No, you'd have to
strip
it.
Be a new conceptual,
yep,
amendment.
That's why I'm just using it as the discussion.
So I guess that's up to Mr. Chair how you want. I think we're getting it really confused. I think we ought to just address this because it's not pertaining to travel.
So your intention is going to be to withdraw this?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's why I said this is just for discussion purposes, and if the committee doesn't want to blow it off, that's fine. Or we can discuss it as a conceptual amendment. That's why I try to be clear up front.
Well, my question for Mr. Skidmore, so this language right here, it's rooted in federal policy, right? Mm-hmm. The part about the temporary lodging use as a sex offender or child kidnapper, it's comes from to us from the federal policy on this, correct?
Chair Holland, you're correct in that the language is found both in the federal registration, so the federal law itself, as well as the guidance that the Department of Justice provides. And when they explain this, and that was actually the sheet that I was looking at, is the guidance that they are providing to us about the term temporary lodging information and what they mean by it and what they're trying to capture.
Okay. So there's no problem with?
No. And why don't we make it clean, Mr. Chairman, if you're okay with it. I'll just withdraw amendment number 3 and then discuss a conceptual amendment for the time limit if we choose to do that at the end. Is that okay?
Sounds
make
good.
It cleaner because it's getting more confusing than I hoped it would.
So I withdraw my objection. You're going to withdraw amendment number 3.
Withdraw amendment number 3.
Amendment number 3. That's a lot of discussion.
Yes, it is. But then we can amendment skip that in the next
withdraw.
Part.
All right. All right. So next up is amendment number 4, labeled G.1 from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 4.
And I will object for a discussion if you'd care to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just get to page 15 here. So page 15, lines 20 through 27. Mr. Chairman, this would delete effectively one section of the bill. It's something we discussed as we were talking about the bill. This is the retroactive requirement for someone who is required to register in another state because of behavior that state puts on a sex offender registry, but Alaska doesn't. So under Alaska law, it's not a registrable sex offense. And while that requirement exists today, this section of the bill would make it retroactive. And this was the conversation we had with the Department of Law about ex post facto. And I think Senator Hughes said it well just a few minutes ago when she said being on a sex offender registry is part of the price you have to pay for your crime. So it is a piece of criminal punishment. And you can't do that retroactively under the U.S. or the Alaska Constitution. Ex post facto punishment isn't allowed. And as we discussed the last time, Alaska's Supreme Court has said this is kind of a different critter. It's part punishment and part regulation. But we don't have a regulatory interest in something we don't require you to register for. If we don't think it's dangerous, if you do it here, we don't regulate it. So we're only talking with this about the punishment piece. And so that that makes it unconstitutional. And so that's why amendment number 4. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Skidmore, can you provide the Department of Law's position on amendment number 4?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the amendment from Senator Keel. The first thing that I would want to clarify is when we talk about the requirement to register in the state of Alaska, if you're required to register from another state, when this was originally proposed in HB 49, it was not simply to address conduct for which you were not required to register in Alaska if you had committed it here. Prior to HB 49 in 2019, the way Alaska law addressed these issues were to say you only had to register if the crime that was committed in the other state had similar elements to the crime that we require people to register for here. The problem that presented is the analysis of whether or not those elements were the same. And those elements could look different, even though the conduct that occurred would have required the person to register if they committed that conduct here, because our crime would have required that registration. In other words, the elements can be different, even though the conduct would have qualified for crime to register here. It's a very complex legal problem that we have faced on any number of occasions. And in addition to that, we had instances in which someone would commit conduct in another state that that state said was registrable, that our state may not have looked at that conduct, may not have made a decision about whether or not we wanted to require it to be registrable or not. But the point was, you had individuals in other states who were contacting Alaska to say, if I move there, do I have to register? And when they were getting the answer, no, you wouldn't have to register here, we found that Alaska became a place that was attracting individuals from other states to avoid registration requirements. They would simply move here. And so what the law did is it said, if you're required to register there, you were convicted, you're required to register, we're going to say you have to register in Alaska. We're going to make a simple, clean analysis so that we can provide clear guidance to any offender out there who needs to know whether or not they'd be required to register here, and the policy reason to ensure that we were not creating a place where people wanted to move simply to avoid those registration requirements. And while I appreciate Senator Keel's comments that there is some portions of the registration that our courts have deemed to be punishable, and he's accurate about that, they have, where they found that was when the person was convicted in our state. But in a more recent Supreme Court case by our Alaska Supreme Court in 2019, they actually decided the question that if somebody has to register in another state, then they can be required to register in our state. And they deemed that those circumstances were not punitive, but in fact were regulatory, and that that was an appropriate regulatory step for them to take. The articulation that they actually provided in that case was, first, the state does have a legitimate public safety concern in requiring out-of-state offenders who now reside in the state to register. Second, there is no concern that a sex offender's conduct was lawful where it occurred. To the contrary, by definition, it resulted from a criminal conviction. What they're saying there is, it's not a question of whether or not we're imposing new punishments on them. They were convicted and they were required to register. And the third thing that the court pointed out in 2019 was that being forced to register as a sex offender in multiple states for the same offense is not like being assessed multiple money judgments for the same conduct. And what they were referring to there was an argument that the offender had made in that case that somehow this would violate ex post facto. So when you go back to that constitutional provision, ex post facto, you cannot punish somebody after the fact. What our Supreme Court said in 2019 is that the requirement to register out-of-state offenders here does not violate ex post facto and that it is permissible to do. And so from the state standpoint, with all due respect, I think we simply have a difference of opinion with Senator Keel. We don't believe that this violates ex post facto, and we do believe that there are appropriate regulatory and policy determinations that this body can make, that the governor certainly supports, and that they don't want Alaska to be a haven, a safe place for people to come to avoid those registration requirements. And that's why this particular provision was being proposed. In 2019, it was only if you moved here after that date. This is the next step in that to say, not only is it if you move here, but for those that have already moved here, it's not punishment, but it is regulatory to say, we want to make sure that we know where you're living, ensure that you're not living next to a school, a youth facility, a playground, some place that children might be. We want to make sure, and there's an appropriate public safety policy that allows us to do that. And last but not least, that 2019 opinion was also the case that said that in Alaska, we now have to have a process, a provision for people to be removed from the registry when they no longer present that public safety danger. That's the regulatory purpose that allows us to do that. And so the court has already ameliorated, reduced the concern about the punishment that I think Senator Keel was addressing, because they can say, If it's not achieving that regulatory purpose, then they can be removed from the registry. All of that happened in 2019. And so those were a significant number of changes that I would submit to you all is important for your consideration as you evaluate this particular policy piece.
I appreciate your striving to explain that in non-legalese. I think I caught much of that. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions for Mr. Skidmore. If we're that concerned about these particular crimes and people registering for them when they register out of state, why hasn't this bill, why doesn't this bill have provisions to make those crimes also registrable if those crimes are committed in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I would tell you that would take an exhaustive review of every other state's registries and for us to evaluate all the crimes that they have, and then that would require us each and every year to try and track what all other 50 states do in terms of how they may make adjustments, and for us then to try to figure out, do we want to follow them in suit each and every year? What this provision did was simply try to say, we're going to capture this in the simplest form possible, and actually the provision that we enacted is the same type of provision that a number of other states have already chosen to enact for these same policy reasons. Instead of trying to track what everybody else is doing, we're simply trying to find that equilibrium to say, look, if you have to register there, we would require you to register here. It's a separate policy call to decide, do we also want to criminalize the same sort of conduct? Do we also want to require registration for that conduct in our state in addition to what we may already do? Those are separate considerations of, we just want to say, if you had to register there, then that would have the same consequences.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. First of all, I have two questions on this topic. One is when you say the, I appreciate the fact that you brought up the 2019 case here. That's helpful, and the determination that it was a regulatory versus a punitive action. And so if I'm on track, just quickly let me know. We don't have to go into anything long, but regulatory would be something such as knowing whether a person is near a school, that kind of thing, just for managing and making sure they're following the rules. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes.
Okay, thank you. The other question I have is if other states have also done something similar to what is being proposed here, and have any of have there been cases where it's been knocked down in other states, or does it seem to be holding?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the difficulty in assessing that is that most other states don't find it punitive in any way, shape, or form. The punitive aspect that our court found was only under the state constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court, in three different times, in 1997, in 2001, and in 2003, in Kansas v. Hendricks, Sealing v. Young, and Smith v. Doe, respectively, in each of those circumstances, the U.S. Supreme Court found that sex offender registries were not punitive and that they were only regulatory. Our Supreme Court in 2008, in another Doe case, said there is a punitive effect, but in that circumstance, what they expressly looked at was we enacted our sex offender registry in 1994, and when we enacted it, we said you would have to register even if you had been convicted of a sex offense prior to our enactment of the registry. In that circumstance, and that circumstance only, the Supreme Court found it to be punitive. And in fact, the 2019 case that I referred to draws that very distinction between those two circumstances, the requirement to register from out of state and what was happening in the 2008 case. So here, other states have not found this to be a problem, but that's primarily because I'm unaware of other states, and I'm not saying that there aren't any, but I'm unaware of other states that have concluded that it's also punitive and therefore would violate ex post facto, because ex post facto is only supposed to be applied to criminal circumstances or where it's punitive.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Schauer.
Two quick ones. John, do you know what the numbers of people we're talking about this would affect, one? And two, Mr. Chairman, maybe since we don't have Ledge Legal, but there is the Alaska Public Defenders, I would be curious just to see of a different opinion, if they might have one, just for the record, please. So maybe John first.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I do not have numbers for that. I would have to check with DPS about that, and I don't know that they were asked to try and pull those types of numbers for today.
Or whoever. Well, that, but that, I just want to see what she thinks about this.
All right. So at this time, Renee McFarland, Alaska Public Defenders. If you can hear me, please, you've been tracking the conversation. Do you have any input to provide on this point?
Through the chair, this is Renee McFarland from the Public Defender Agency. I've been following the conversation. I didn't get a copy of the amendments until the beginning of the hearing, so I'm just now looking at it. I believe Mr. Skidmore correctly paraphrased the court's decision in Doe, but I haven't reviewed it recently. I am a little hesitant to say fully one way or the other what our position is without having the opportunity to go back and look a little more closely at everything. I would agree that Alaska does find registration to be punitive in a way that other courts have not. I don't know that we're completely unique in that, but I do agree that many courts have not found that to be the case. The one thing I would note is that, you know, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but some of the other states do require registration for acts that Alaska does not, including things such as public urination and misdemeanor offenses like that. And given the effect that the sex offender registry can have on people's reintegration into society in a non-criminal matter, those are the concerns with requiring registration for these other offenses. But nothing that Mr. Skidmore said has jumped out at me as something that we would disagree with, but what I can do is I can let the committee know after review if there's anything else so that I understand we're at a later hearing in this, and so, but I will let the committee know if we identify anything problematic.
All right, thank you, Ms. McFarland. Also, so Lisa Parrington is also standing by on the line, and I believe that the Senator Shaw, did you want to repeat your question about numbers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Lisa, just wondering if you would have numbers on how many people this might affect based on the amendment if it was to pass, like the numbers of the individuals affected.
For the record, Lisa Parrington, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau with Department of Public Safety. To the chair, to Senator Shower's question, unfortunately, I don't have those numbers precisely. That is certainly something we can look at getting for the committee. I can say that on average, we get about two new registrants for out-of-state offenses each week, and that has been fairly steady through the Sex Offender Office.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Parrington. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mrs. Skidmore. If we're only talking about people that moved here before 2019, if I remember right, there's some time limits how long you have to be on the registry based on what your crime was. At what time, let's say somebody moved here in 2012, 2015, you know, wouldn't this sort of resolve itself over the years since we're only talking about people that moved here prior to 2019? When would those time limits be running out?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, it's an excellent question. The answer to the question, you have to go back to the statutes. And what we decided in 2019 is that for those individuals that require to register from another state, that their registration period would be the same as it had been in the other state in coming to Alaska. So that would require us to go and look and figure out how long they had been required to register there. I can't give you a definitive how long it will take for all of that to work its way out. I can tell you that under the federal guidelines, there are really supposed to be three tiers. One of them's lifetime. One of them's, I want to say, around 15 years. And I think the other one's around 5 years. So it depends upon the type of offense that they would have committed.
Okay, thank you. And
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I have a question for Lisa Purinton. Based on you, over 100 a year moving here from out of state, and Mr. Skidmore mentioned that sometimes they're calling to find out if they would have to register. Of course, these that are moving here are registering, and you're aware of it. So. Well, I know you said you would have to get back with us, but just based on the number and types of offenses, do you think we have as many or more moving here annually because they don't have to register?
For the record, Lisa Prunton again, through the chair to Senator Schauer's question. When we have registrants come in from out of state, we research the criminal history records to research the conviction for what they were required to register for in that other state. That information is given to the Department of Law, as Mr. Skidmore had pointed out. It's a very legal review process on finding the elements of the crime, not necessarily the conduct of the crime, to be determined if it would be comparable to an existing state law for that, because these crimes were committed prior to 2019, when the out-of-state reciprocity, for lack of a better term, was put into play under HB 49. So with those, we do see a fair number of these are deemed to be not registrable in Alaska based on the current review process that is done. So we do have a fair number of those that we advise that they're not required to register based on the existing language in the law. So that's why I said it's kind of hard to get a specific number of how many are currently registered with an out-of-state offense versus how many were advised that they don't have to register based on the current law.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Kiel, do you have something?
I was ready for wrap-up, Mr. Chairman, but if there are more questions.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. Last one, I promise. For Mr. Skidmore, if this passes, is there a possibility then that there are Alaskans who would lose their housing if we then have to make them register?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I don't know of any provision that would cause someone to lose their housing. I think they are required to register where they live, but I don't know that there's any provision of law that says they lose their house under those circumstances.
Elaborate, Senator Myers.
apparently, there's three Senator Showers here today. I'm trying to remember the exact details. I seem to remember that if you're on the sex offender registry, you're not allowed to live in certain areas. For example, within a certain distance of a school or a couple of other places. And I'm wondering if somebody had moved here, let's say in 2015, had lived within had found an apartment, let's say 100 yards from school, everything was going fine. Now we have to put him on a sex offender registry if that's now, if that section now applies, and he'd have to move.
I thought that's where you're going with it.
So I'm going to actually
throwing a lifeline to you.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Kelly Howell from the Department of Public Safety. I'm not familiar with a provision that says they can't live there, but I do know that they have to register.
Ms. Howell, so place yourself on the record, provide any input.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. Senator Myers, through the chair, the current law does not have any proximity limitations on where sex offenders may live, provided they are not under any other, you know, conditions of supervision through the Department of Corrections that would place those limitations on them. But in general, the sex offender registration requirements do not have any limitations on where a sex offender may reside.
Okay, thank you.
So just to clarify, you don't see a complication as far as someone being forced to move out of their house because now they have to register?
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Thank you. All right. Any further questions from the committee? Senator Hughes.
So we talked about a regulatory reason for mm-hmm. this kind of thing might be being in a house near school as an administrative thing. So can you give me another example, since we don't have any restrictions on proximity as far as a regulatory reason?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the type of regulatory reasons is, for example, what you described, that you want to know, are you in a property that is near a sex offender? I as a parent, would want to know, am I living near someone that now I have to talk to my children about, or do I need to give them warnings, or is there somebody that I should be watching? And that can apply whether it's my neighbor. That can apply if there's a particular park that I want to go and visit with my children. That can apply if there is some other venue that I want to go to. We don't necessarily have amusement parks in Alaska, but for instance, in Florida and California, places like that, that's one of those other things that people want to look at and think about. The regulatory purpose is not that you want to punish someone. It's so that the other citizens can make informed choices about the activities that they're going to be engaged in and the risks that they may be taking if they go to a particular place. You could talk about parks. You could talk about schools. You could talk about recreational facilities. There's any number of things like that that you can think of where you simply want to know, what are the risks that this would entail for me as a citizen? That's not punishing anyone. That's just a regulatory purpose for public safety, which is what they talk about in that 2019 opinion.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Wrap up from Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe I'll start with Senator Meyer's question. I appreciate that there is no governmental requirement that would move somebody out of their house, but their landlord might. Right. So the consequence, I think, is potentially there. As we think through what we're talking about here, we have talked about a couple of things that are criminal here, but not sex offenses. That are registrable as on sex offender registries elsewhere. At least one of the members who was on judiciary back in 2019 will recall, there are some things that are not criminal behavior here that are registrable elsewhere. There are other states with closer margins between different definitions of the family relationships that are not allowed to have sexual relations, or the age gaps. So there are actually situations where you could register in another state that are simply not even a crime in Alaska. And so when we talk about putting somebody on the registry for those, we're stepping over, I think, an important line. The Alaska Supreme Court does do a parallel analysis of this punishment and regulation thing. And in the case that was referred to from 2019, we were talking about behavior that is absolutely criminal everywhere. I think Virginia calls it sexual battery. We call it sexual assault in the first degree. That is not what we are talking about in this amendment. It's nowhere close. And then the last thing I would just note, so that we get the full picture, is that the removal process from Alaska Sex Offender Registry, that the Alaska Supreme Court required, still doesn't exist. We haven't made that yet. So we ought not say to ourselves, oh, don't worry about it, because they can get off. That isn't a thing yet. Someday it's going to have to be a thing, but it ain't. So my concern here is just as I said when I introduced the amendment. We really do have an overbroad situation where we have an element of punishment for something that Alaska doesn't regulate for. Sometimes Alaska doesn't even prosecute for. But if you did it somewhere else, you'd have to be a registered on a sex offender, child kidnapper registry in Alaska, with all the consequences that entails. HB 49's requirement that you register from other states hasn't been tested in court yet. I think it's probably going to stand up in court unless we make it retroactive to stuff that isn't a registrable sex offense here. The offender had no way of knowing when they pled or whatever it was that it was going to affect their plans afterwards. Right, they didn't have that due process element because this is ex post facto. So I encourage a yes vote on Amendment 4, please.
I appreciate your point of view, Senator Akil. I appreciate Mr. Skidmore providing input from the Department of Law. I will maintain my objection. And this will go to a vote. And Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
No.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Schauer.
No.
Senator Holland.
No.
Two yeas, three nays.
two yeas and three nays. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question briefly?
Senator Schauer.
Senator Keel says something that now I'm waffling on this one, but it's not for this amendment. But he did say something that there was an interesting reaction from Department of Law about not having that, which I was not aware of, to get off of the registry. Could they just yes or no answer if that is in fact the case? I would like to know that, because that is something that does not sit well if that is in fact true.
Mr. Skidmore, were you tracking that?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, Senator Keel is correct in that the statutes have not been amended for that purpose, but Senator Keel is probably simply unaware of the litigation that is ongoing. There are individuals that have been removed from the registry because they have been found not to be dangerous. I know of at least five that have already occurred. There is ongoing litigation about that, and we see more litigation that's filed each and every day.
One very small fault, I promise you.
Always just, one more small
I know there's
fault.
Always one more.
Another shower.
Is that, but for them to get off the registry then, there is not a process and they have to litigate to do so? Is that the case?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, the courts are left to make that process for themselves, because at this time the legislature has not chosen to take up the issue of what that process should look like.
Understood. Thank you.
All right. Any more discussion on this? Seeing none. So now we move on to Amendment Number 5, labeled G.9, from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment Number 5.
I'll object for discussion. Please explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we had a little conversation about this description. This is the new language about when there is lack of consent. And this is at page 4, starts at line 18. Where that question of was there lack of consent is at issue. The bill says a current or previous dating, social or sexual relationship, or the manner of dress of the person involved with the defendant and the conduct that we're talking about at issue, may not by itself constitute consent. And the committee is going to remember that when this came up, I had a pretty strong reaction to putting manner of dress in here at all. And we had some discussion with the department about prohibiting manner of dress from being one of those elements. The department pushed back pretty hard that we ought not prohibit that, that there may be some rare situations where that's an appropriate part of the totality of the circumstances. I wasn't convinced, but the department also said that if we prohibit considering it, they think the courts may actually strike this down as overbroad. I don't want to risk that. So what this amendment does is it simply deletes any mention of the manner of dress. And what I believe that the effect of that will be is that we will no longer specifically say manner of dress is one thing that you can consider among others. I think that most juries will not have any interest in considering manner of dress, and they will reject arguments about manner of dress. But if there's that one rare situation where something comes up and a defense attorney can make one hell of a case, maybe. So by deleting it, we don't give special permission to count that each time as one of the factors, but we don't prohibit it.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Go to Mr. Skidmore or Casey Schroeder for does the Department of Law have any input on this amendment?
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Department of Law. I agree with Senator Keel's characterization of the discussion at the last hearing. I think we had a pretty robust discussion about manner of dress. And what I hope the committee took away from that discussion was that whether or not the legislature wants language in the statute or wants it changed regarding manner of dress, that's a decision for the legislature. What the Department of Law is saying is we're cautioning against an absolute bar for those instances in which Senator Keel described, where perhaps there may be an argument that it is relevant to consider in the totality of the circumstances, and it would go towards whether or not the defendant acted recklessly. And so this really is a decision for the legislature.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Any discussion from the committee? With that, I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to this amendment?
I'm going to object, at least to discuss just a little bit more.
Okay.
Thinking through what's been stated. If we were to pass this amendment, then the dress couldn't even be considered in an overall consideration of multiple factors. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, no. The language that was previously drafted said no, absolutely never. It was an absolute bar, and that is what the department cautioned against, and then we asked for a language change, and that was what the language was that we discussed at the last hearing. If that language is removed, as in Senator Keel's amendment, the state of the law would be what it is now. It would be up to the defendant to argue relevance.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm still confused. So if this amendment passes, clothing could be considered or could not be considered in the totality?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the defendant would be able to make an argument in the totality of the circumstances analysis.
So it
can, and even in the yeah, converse.
Yeah, in on this conversation. So whether it's there or not, it doesn't seem to make a big difference. We're not making a big policy call if it's in or out, because they can still consider it.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, as the language is drafted in version G, it is softened. It's not an absolute bar, and we think that's probably okay. But it really is up to the legislature whether or not you want to in or out. And it may not make a big difference in implementation.
And follow up.
But
if we pass Senator Keel's, if we're deleting in the manner of dress, we're taking out the language, you're still saying it still could be considered. Am I hearing you correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the language in version G in the CS says that the manner of dress by itself may not be considered. So it could be considered in a totality of the circumstances analysis. The defendant could argue relevance, as Senator Keel said. And if you take it out, that would likely also be the state of the law.
So either way, it could be considered.
Correct.
Okay, so I'll remove my objection.
All right. Is there any further objection from the committee? With no further objection, that was amendment number 5, labeled G.9 from Senator Keel, is adopted. All right. Next up is amendment number 6, also from Senator Keel. Amendment number 6, labeled G.3.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move amendment 6.
And I will object for discussion if you'd care to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I don't want to, but this is one of those. And I apologize for the conversation that I feel like we have to get this right. Because it's gross. And I mean, all of this is disturbing, but Mr. Chairman, what amendment number 6 does, let me just give you the effect of it first. The effect of amendment 6 is to take contact with semen, criminal, inappropriate contact with semen that doesn't have a sexual element to the contact, and keep that in the misdemeanor crime. And so what the way that would work, just so we're clear, back when we were looking at HB 49, I think actually we had a separate bill that dealt with the Schneider case, that terrible incident. And this would effectively leave that thoroughly and awfully considered law where it ended up when we passed that bill. If there is, if someone is exposed to semen in a sex act and there is force involved, as in the Schneider case, that's a B felony. That's what we did in that bill a few years ago. That's what would remain here. We don't change that. If there is contact with semen in a sex act and the victim is unconscious or unaware, that would be a sexual assault. In the third degree, that'd be a C felony. If there is contact with semen in a sexual act and there's not consent, that's also sexual assault. It's a C felony. And I should flag here that, as some of the members who were here at the time will remember, if someone masturbates in someone else's presence and they don't want to see it, that's indecent exposure in the first. That's a C felony. So I want to make clear to the committee, we're trying not to leave any loopholes here for the sexualized act. But with this amendment, if there is contact with semen in other situations separated from the sexual act, a dirty rag is thrown, fluids are flung, horrible things that we hate to think about. They are criminal things. Those would be harassment in the first, and those would be an A misdemeanor. That's the effect of Amendment Number 6. It leaves that A misdemeanor category in existence, just like contact with feces, contact with urine, when that contact with semen is separated from the sex act.
Sorry. Thank you, Senator Keel. No apologies necessary. Department of Law, do y'all have input on this as far as do the words on the paper equate to what Senator Keel thinks it's going to do? And does Department of Law have any input to offer on this?
John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. Members of Senate Judiciary, I would tell you that Senator Keel's amendment is really just about classification. It's about punishment. He is not in any way proposing to legalize any conduct. He is rather talking about how do you punish it with this amendment. And the decision that you have to make is whether or not contact with semen will be qualified as a sexual assault in the third degree under the bill that's in front of you, which would be a Class C felony as a sex offense, punishable by 2 to 12 years on a first offense. Or, if you were to adopt Senator Keel's amendment, it would remove it from sexual assault in the third degree and effectively say this will simply qualify as harassment. And as the harassment, it would be a Class A misdemeanor, subject from 0 to 1. Now, I want to be clear that when we talk about the contact with semen as it applies in this particular bill, it is only under the new definition of consent. If there is force or the threat of force and there is that contact with semen, that is a higher level offense of sexual assault in the second degree. Senator Keel's amendment doesn't change that in any way, shape, or form. He is only adjusting where this is dealt with for the new definition of consent that would be in this bill. And I think I don't mean to speak for him, but I think the rationale behind that concept is that, for instance, in the Department of Corrections, we have offenders who want to annoy or harass their corrections officers, and you'll see the list of body substances that are secreted that they then take and fling, cause to be airborne, throw through the air at the corrections officer to annoy or harass them, which is why it was originally found in harassment. And so I think what Senator Keel's amendment does is attempt to say that should not be classified as a sex offense. And if the rest of the committee agrees and that's not to be a sex offense, then that would be in harassment where it is currently as a Class A misdemeanor subject to 0 to 1 year in jail. That's really the call that's being made here.
Senator Hughes.
Now, you mentioned it, if force is involved, that changes everything. So
yes.
I'm thinking of a setting, in a correction setting with inmates, and someone flings the semen, and mm-hmm. there are other inmates around, and all of a sudden a fist fight breaks out, and there's contact with the semen, not by the person that is flinging it. Are they all of a sudden, because they're using force and there's semen being passed back and forth, we wouldn't want to put a sex offense on that person. So would that be able to be separated from this?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the answer is yes. The force that I describe has to be force that is what's used to overcome the resistance to the sexual contact, in this case, the contact with semen. So it's not the there's semen in a location and there's a fist fight, now somebody comes into contact with it. That's not what the law would be looking at. The law would be looking at a situation in which one person is restraining the individual while someone else came up and tried to forcibly put the substance on them. In that circumstance, then it would be deemed a sex offense in that situation.
Okay, as long as that's clear.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since it took up so much earlier discussion, I need to ask it as well. With the difference here between the potential C felony and the potential A misdemeanor, what is the difference in terms of somebody who commits either crime in terms of the sex offender registry?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the registry for a sexual assault in the third degree, I believe, is 15 years. The registry for harassment, I hear Ms. Schroeder next to me flipping to find the right page to answer that question for you appropriately. Give me just one moment. And so, thank you for that confirmation. In the version you have in front of you, the repealer would actually say that someone that is convicted of the harassment would not need to register as a sex offender.
All right. Is there any other questions or concerns from the committee? Seeing none, I will remove my objection at this time. Is there any further objection to amendment number 6? Seeing none, amendment number 6 is adopted. Amendment number 6, label G.3, is adopted. All right. Amendment number 7 was kind of pending amendment number 6. So amendment number 7 will not be offered. And now we're on the late arrival, amendment number 8. Amendment number 8, labeled G.6, is offered by Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman, offer amendment number 8.
I will object for explanation, if you care to explain your amendment.
We are, this is for discussion purposes primarily, but the Department of Law has had a chance to discuss it briefly because we hit them kind of late with this one, not intentional. And we have a concern, so I'd just like it addressed so that to make sure we're not, again, setting people up to fail. That's really a lot of the cross-check, I think, even as you can see the amendments, to make sure we're not, going a little too far with some of these. So if you look at Section 8 and Section 9, I'll just, briefly throw it out and have the Department of Law answer to it. In prosecution for a failure to register as a sex offender, child kidnapper in the first degree of this section, and you can see the same in Section 9, it is an affirmative defense that the person is a homeless individual with no permanent or temporary address. And so what we're trying to do here is make sure that, somebody's moving around. They don't have a permanent address. We know people have homeless camps. Anchorage has a real big problem with that. And if they don't have that and don't register, what would happen to them? So I just, if we get on the record, have Department of Law talk to it, on how this would play out, because that's, again, the same thing, Mr. Chair. We don't want to set people up to be further charged when they don't have a great capability as it is just trying to get by and exist. So I'll let Department of Law answer to that.
Does Department of Law have any input on Amendment Number 8?
To the Chair, this is, for the record, John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Alaska Department of Law. I appreciate Senator Schauer's concerns and efforts. I will tell the committee that our concern would be that there are sex offenders who are, in fact, homeless. And what this would say is that any sex offender who is homeless would never have to report or register where it is they reside. And some people are kind of probably scratching their heads and saying, well, if you're homeless, how do you report where your home is? The answer to that very simply is that we ask those individuals to tell us where it is that they have their camp, where it is that they are sleeping. Is it at a homeless shelter? Is there a physical camp? And give us a description of where that's located. The same concepts that we described earlier about why we do that, to see whether or not somebody is setting up their camp that's right next to a park where citizens might want to take their kids. Is this right next to a school? Is it a high school? Is it an elementary school? Is this a daycare center? Where is it that this person is staying That's the way that we look at this right now in current law. And what this would do is essentially gut that. This would say any sex offender who doesn't want to register simply says, hey, I'm not going to have a home. And you could do that even by living in, for example, a recreational vehicle. That's something capable of moving from one place to another. And yet that could be your home that would constantly move, and you would say that you were homeless in those circumstances. So while I appreciate Senator Schauer's concerns and trying to make sure that the registry doesn't go too far, I would submit to you this would be of a serious concern, not only to the Department of Law, but I believe to those in law enforcement that we work with in trying to make sure that there is compliance with the sex offender registry. There was a question that Senator Schauer had asked me prior to the hearing. Do I know how many people that might actually qualify for? I do not know that information off the top of my head. I know that Ms. Purrington is online. I think that question was conveyed to her. I don't know if she's had an opportunity to try and figure that out in the short amount of time that we've had to look at it. So I don't want to put her on the spot in that we are expecting an answer, but if she does have an answer, if that's of interest to the committee, I did want to offer that.
Senator Schauer, is that what you were?
I would like to – I didn't think of that from John's question. That would be good, but also I just wanted to hear from the public defender if they had a position as well, just to get the full breadth of an answer. Thank you.
All right, we'll go to Ms. Purrington first, if she was listening in, if she has an idea of the numbers that are involved in this.
For the record, Lisa Purrington, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief. Through the chair to Senator Schauer's question, unfortunately, we have not had a chance to – review the records to determine how many of the offenders currently registered would be deemed as homeless as not having a permanent fixed residency. But that is something that we are looking to try to obtain those numbers for the committee.
All right, thank you. And then also Renee McFarland. Ms. McFarland, if you are listening in, if you have any input to offer on Amendment Number 8.
The chair to Senator Schauer. I have actually not seen the amendment. The link online goes to three blank pages. So without being able to see the actual language, I can't speak to the specifics of what's done. I mean, what the amendment proposes to do. But I would note that for our homeless clients, registration is a problem, mostly because of some lack of uniformity about how they register. And we have cases where homeless individuals are charged with failure to register because of issues related to their placement. So it does present a concern, but I can't speak to the specific amendment because I can't see the language.
Mr. Chairman, here's what I'd like to do, if it's okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Because I don't want to gut something I know especially is important for law enforcement and their ability to prosecute their job, and because I don't have a good answer right now, and we kind of came up with this late, what I would ask, Mr. Chairman, is if the Public Defender's Office could provide an analysis once we get this to them of what they think, if there is a better answer that still allows for making sure that a dangerous offender is registered, but not so much that it trips them up, then I will look for that answer, and I'm going to withdraw this amendment at this time and look to potentially just maybe perhaps put one on the floor or in a further committee and ask it to be run there after there's some time to flush it out a little better. So I withdraw Amendment Number 8.
All right, Senator Schauer, thank you. Amendment Number 8 is withdrawn. All right. At that point, if I am counting correctly, I think we've run out of amendments. And are there any further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I know, I just asked the committee if they have any interest, and I can do the same thing I just did on this one and put it in at a later time, but is there any interest in looking at the amendment that I pulled about setting a more codified timeline for someone to register in travel status? If there is here, we could debate it for a minute or two and maybe do a conceptual amendment if we would like to do it at a later time because of time and constraints. I'm happy to do it later, but I asked for the will of the committee on it.
We have at least about 20 minutes, so we could maybe – is there any input from the committee on this, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be interested in seeing if we could put some clarifiers in there. I think that the bill actually has time frames when you're out of state. I don't know that it has time frames when you're in state. And so it's worth a look, Mr. Chairman, just so we can, if we're going to have something people need to comply with, it's entirely possible I've misunderstood that, but if we're going to have time frames for people to comply with, maybe we should get a clearer result if we spell them out.
I'm sorry, repeat your last.
Maybe we get a better result if we spell out the requirements.
A brief at ease. All right, thank you, Senate Judiciary is back on the record. I didn't want too much conversation to happen off the record. Senator Schauer, did you have a
question? I think it was just Mr. Skidmore was going to kind of answer that. He was finishing up there. It's basically the question is, do we want to put, and Senator Keel asked one that he may want Mr. Skidmore to answer as well. I wasn't aware of one in and out of state based on travel, but maybe it applies to both. Do we want to codify what that timeline is? And John was just getting kind of ready to answer that when we stopped. So whether it's necessary or not is a judgment call. It is left open, and he was kind of just saying that at the end there when we stopped. Maybe let him finish that thought, see where it goes.
Mr. Skidmore?
Members of Senate Judiciary, what I would tell you is that when you are attempting to codify requirements about how quickly someone does something, the challenges that you all will face, much in the same way that I think you all like to think through hypotheticals to try and help you understand things and to think of all the different scenarios to make sure you cover them, I would submit to you that if you try to come up with a hard and fast, it's going to be in this number of hours or this number of days, we could play those same hypotheticals with you all and you would go, oh, wait a minute, that's not really what I was trying to accomplish. I would submit to you that currently in statute, under Alaska Statute 1156-840, which is the crime that we file against someone for failing to register, under subsection B of that statute, it is an affirmative defense when there are unforeseeable circumstances outside the control of the person and what they're required to do for this offense, the defense to apply, is that they must orally or in writing, immediately upon being able to perform the required requirements described in this section. That is, if their residence changes, if they're going to be someplace else, then when it is possible for them to report that, either orally or in writing, then they are supposed to do so. And it's only when they fail to do that that then we would evaluate the prosecution in those circumstances. So put another way, I think that that defense tries to capture what is reasonable under the circumstances that are there, and then allows the practitioners to sort through, do we think that's reasonable? And there are several levels of check on that. The first is the prosecutor. What does the prosecutor think would be reasonable? And then second, even if the prosecutor thought, this is unreasonable, I'm going to file charges here, that then goes to a jury. And members of the public listen to those same circumstances, and they decide, did I think that that was reasonable or unreasonable? And then they get to make the determination about whether or not this person failed to comply in those circumstances. That's the approach that the Department of Law would actually recommend is followed. I think if you try and put a specific time frame, you will find yourselves tripped up with those same hypotheticals. What can I think of in all these different ways? I think you would find yourself on the receiving end of that in a way that you probably were not wanting to be.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly. And I'm done.
It's
it's very brief. I'm the briefest guy you got, Mr. Chairman.
You hear something 100 times, you stop believing it. Senator Schauer.
I'm going to come up with a new one just for that. Hey, very longly, Mr. Chair. So the word affirmative makes me more comfortable with it in this conversation. Plus, we're getting it on the record, the why. So that also helps me. So we've built that record. I would like to know, though, Mr. Chairman, if there was anything to what Senator Keel asked about in or out of state. I hadn't thought of that. If there's not, that's fine, but I'm satisfied at this point.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Oh, Senator, well, I see Senator Keel's got the hookup.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking back. I think I'm wrong. If I look at page 9, line 17, I think away from your primary residence, physical address, for 7 days or more, you have to notify and write. I think I said that wrong. I'll look at the Department of Law and see.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would agree with your second assessment.
That you are wrong.
Yep. Fair enough.
You wouldn't say it, but Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick clarification, Mr. Skidmore. You said that notification either orally or in writing would also include by telephone or email?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So after that discussion, are there any further amendments? I don't see any. Is there any further debate? Senator Schauer. We still have time. We're doing good.
Comment.
Senator Hughes.
I am happy that we're at this point where we're moving this bill out. This is the sexual crime rates in the state are per capita are the worst in the nation, as we've all heard ad nauseum. And it's important that we as policymakers do what we can to change that. And so a lot of this work started back in prior to 2019, actually. So it's been 3 or 4 years in the making. And so this is, I believe, the first sexual crime bill in this legislative session that is moving out of a committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
At least on the Senate side. And so I'm just, it's strange to use the word happy in relation to this topic, but I am truly thankful for the work that you all have done. And you've been always incredibly available to help us sort these things out. And I just appreciate also, Mr. Chair, you and your staff working through this and getting this along. You know, there was a suggestion that this was being thrown out in an election year late. But, you know, this stuff is complicated. And it is, you know, I would hope that in this building we would not put off addressing this matter because it's an election year. This is too important of an issue to make political. And we need to get on the stick, and we need to get all these sexual crime bills through, vet them, and get through what we believe is the right thing for the people of Alaska. So I'm proud to be part of this committee and moving this bill out today.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with what Senator Hughes had to say, and I'll just add one more thought. I think that the work this committee has done, along with the administration, on the definition of consent and a sexual act without consent, is a big leap. I think it's a big move forward, and I think it reflects excellent work from the administration and from the members of the committee. I hope that with these additional tools in hand, and this may sound a little strange, I hope their conviction rates go down. And the reason I say that is the testimony we heard earlier on about this bill and the other bill we've been working on. and I don't want to mischaracterize, but the message I took from it was that these cases are expensive and hard, and so that if they're not slam dunks, they don't go to the jury. That's probably too much to take from it. But I hope that future administrations come to the legislature for the resources they need to take cases where they believe the victim, even if it's not a slam dunk to the jury. And I hope that these tools let them do that, and that we as legislators into the future look at a dropping conviction rate and say they're taking the tough cases, we're tackling the problem.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Totally understand. Any other questions or comments from the committee? I will say thanks to the committee for their patience and working through all these issues. Thanks to Department of Law, Public Safety, Division of Courts, Public Defenders. Appreciate everybody's assistance on this. And at this point, I will look to Senator Schauer for the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Bill 187, Work Order 32-GS2031/G as amended be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes.
So without objection, Senate Bill 187 has been reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee as amended with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes. We're still working on the committee substitute for Senate Bill 189, so I'm going to roll that forward to Monday in anticipation of it showing up. Is there any other business? Seeing none, we will go ahead and adjourn at this point. Please stay, you know, do the paperwork. Our next meeting is Monday, March 14th at 1:30 p.m. We are adjourned at 2:55 p.m.